Welcome to the True North Community Church Podcast.
All right. So, if it's your first time here, you might be thinking, what did I just watch right now? Well, little recap for you. We're in our last week of our Life of King David series, and throughout the series, we've had children retell the classic tale of David in the Bible. It's been a lot of fun. It's been great. And to give you a brief recap, David is one of the most popular figures in the biblical narrative. He's a heavy hitter in biblical authorship, and he's also the David for which every David you have ever met in your entire life has been named after, okay? So just a reminder on who David was. He was a lowly shepherd boy and a poet who became a warrior and a king, and he was designated by God to lead, and lead he did. Now again, if it's your first time here, you might be thinking, okay, why are we talking about a guy that lived like thousands of years ago? It's 2017. I have to go to work tomorrow. Are you going to say something that's going to make sense to my life today? And the short answer is yes, and I hope that you will suspend that disbelief for the next 20, 25 minutes, because what we're going to talk about today is something very, very simple. It's a principle that's evident in everything from science to philosophy: cause and effect. Cause and effect. Now, the last 5 weeks have been snippets of who David was. We've given you the Cliff's Notes on his story, and overall, it's been a pretty great story, but there's a lot in King David's story that is dark, and this particular story today is lengthy, so I'm going to do my best to compress it for time, but I need to issue a disclaimer on the front end. We're going to talk about some pretty serious things today. Just wanted to throw that out there if you've got kids. Today's story is gruesome. And you know, we've had a lot of kids tell some funny stories up here. You might be thinking, where are the kids? Did they get to tell the story? There's no way we're letting kids tell this story today. Okay, we're gonna get serious for a minute here. In fact, if you've ever watched an episode of Game of Thrones and thought, wow, that's like really messed up, you probably haven't read enough of the Old Testament, because a lot of the things that are present in fictional literature actually happened in the Bible, okay? So that's, I just wanted to let you know that's where we're going today. This is a terrible story. And why are we hearing this? Why is this even in the Bible? Well, we all love the story where the hero saves the day, right? But sometimes tragedies teach us a lesson that heroes never could. And that's what this story is about. So let me set the stage for you. David has now ruled as the king for quite some time. He's in the latter half of his life. Maybe you could even say the last quarter of his life. And like any good leader, he's done a good job. He's tried his best. He's made some really great progress, but he's also made some pretty serious blunders. In fact, he's done some pretty bad stuff. And one of the more notable, horrible things that King David, our hero, did was that he had a man killed. Not by outright murder. He conveniently sent this man to the front lines of battle and then withdrew the support that he had so that the enemy would assassinate him. He did this deliberately and on purpose so that he could marry this man's widow. Pretty dark move. And he did this, and as a result, a prophet comes to him and tells him, hey, I saw what you did. God's given you power, and now you've done this. There's going to be some consequences for it. God has seen it. Now, as customary for that time period, of course, that rattles David, but David continues living life. He has a couple wives. These wives bear him children, and he has two sons named Amnon and Absalom. Amnon, the older, Absalom, the second, and Tamar, a daughter. So he has three kids. And as these children begin to grow older and move into their adolescence and adulthood, Amnon begins to develop feelings for his own sister, which I know is gross, but we're just getting started. Okay, so bear with me here. This is where it gets really dark. Just want to say this again, just issuing a disclaimer. So Amnon's not doing good. He's got some pretty deep-seated issues. And as he gets older, and as the children get older, Amnon manages to invite his sister over. He gets her alone. And while they are there alone, he violently sexually assaults her there. He does this to his own sister. And afterwards, after he's done with her, he despises her for what happened. Check this out. 2 Samuel chapter 13. Then suddenly, Amnon's love turned to hate, and he hated her even more than he had loved her. Let's be clear about this. Amnon doesn't love his sister. This isn't love as we understand it. He saw her as an object. He saw her as a means to an end. And after he's done with her, after he finishes there, he hates her for what happens. And Tamar, the sister, is so beset with grief and with loss. She goes into weeping. She immediately goes into mourning. And as she's on her way out from there, their brother Absalom, the younger brother, sees this. He asks her what's going on. He puts his arms around her, tells her it's not her fault, and he takes care of her. I feel like I need to push pause here for just a minute and talk about the issue of sexual assault, because it comes up, seems to be coming up as a topic in the public every few weeks now. And if you'll permit me to just step on this soapbox for a minute, I'm going to be very direct with you here. I can't believe that I've had to do this, but I've already had multiple conversations with my 7-year-old and with my 5-year-old, because they need to know what the world is like. And I've told them what to watch out for, what to do, and I've let them know that anytime anything happens, they can always come to me or my wife, Rochelle, and they can talk about anything. Why would I do something like that? Because those who would willfully harm others aren't just criminals. Sometimes they're executives or role models or coaches or teachers or clergy or politicians. And if you've ever thought for just a moment, even a fleeting moment, that the survivor is somehow to blame for this, well, that's exactly how Amnon felt. And there's a word for what you're experiencing. And again, I'm going to be very direct here. You're wrong. You're wrong if you feel that way. There's not another angle. There's not some missing variable here. Oh, what did they say? What were they wearing? No, I'm sorry. Assailants are to blame every single time, full stop. And if you haven't gone through it, you can't possibly understand what it's like. Victims and survivors experience a terrible amount of shame and guilt, and I've been told by some that even speaking of it is just as traumatic as reliving it. And respectfully, survivors don't owe us a story. We don't need any more stories. We need a reformation on how we treat people who are made in the image of God. We need to rethink how we live and how we act, and we need to have the courage to do the right thing the first time around. So now I will step off this soapbox. Thank you. I will now step off the soapbox and we'll transition back to our story here. So Amnon does this terrible thing to his sister. Absalom knows what happens. The younger brother, he takes her in and he cares for her. And King David, our hero, finds out about this. And the Bible says he was furious. And that's it. He does absolutely nothing. He sits on his hands. He doesn't punish his older son for what's happened. That's all he does. No justice, no punitive action. Let me ask you this. Have you ever done something that you knew to be wrong, and then later on, you had to correct someone else for doing the exact same thing or something similar? Unless you're a narcissist without a conscience, that's really hard to do. That's really hard to do. Remember, David has blood on his hands. He had a man killed so he could take his wife. David may not have been able to discipline his own son because he lacked the authority and the moral courage to do the right thing. His own integrity was compromised. Cause and effect. What he did before affected him later on in life. And that decision that David made long ago, and the decision that he makes at this very moment, sets into action a chain of events that are catastrophic. So what happens? 2 years go by. 2 years after this incident, David knows about it. Whole family knows about it. Everybody knows about it. Nobody's talking about it. Apparently, no one's even thinking about it, except for Absalom, the younger son. I need to tell you about Absalom. Check this out. 2 Samuel chapter 14. You might even find this funny. Now, Absalom was praised as the most handsome man in all of Israel. He was flawless from head to foot. He cut his hair only once a year, and then only because it was so heavy. When he weighed it out, it came to 5 pounds. I don't know that the Bible's ever gone to such great lengths to describe how good-looking a man is. Like, this guy, he's good-looking. He's got this beautiful head of hair that weighs 5 pounds. Okay, I don't even know. I don't even have a parallel for that right now. Here's what I think about Absalom. Even though he's the younger son, I think he's probably a favorite of his dad. I think David probably saw a little bit of himself in Absalom. But Absalom is like David times 10. He's even because he's smoother. He's charismatic. He's well-liked. People like him. I can imagine him walking around the palace, giving high fives to all the servants every day. He is a well-liked guy. Absalom is also intelligent and extremely dangerous because he was secretly enraged that his dad did nothing. He burned with anger that David didn't act. But Absalom played it cool. Absalom's a slow player. And for 2 years, he pretends like everything's fine. He's cool with the family. He's cool with everybody else. And then one night, he decides that he's going to invite his older brother, Amnon, for dinner. Hey, bro, come over. Let's have a meal. They have dinner, conversation, a few drinks, a few more drinks. And while Amnon has a good buzz going on, Absalom orders his men to cut him down. He murders his own brother in his home. And then Absalom flees the city. Now, at this point, you might be thinking, good. Someone had to do it. And if David wasn't going to act, maybe this was the right thing. Maybe this had to happen. Let me be clear about one thing. Absalom is the second in line. Amnon was the heir to the throne. Absalom just killed the prince. If you think he just did this to avenge his sister, you're wrong. He was securing his place as next in line. The incident that happened to his sister was the opportunity that he needed. And so when David hears this, dear old dad, King David, he immediately goes into mourning. Now, his household is obviously a mess. His kids are nuts. The whole place is in disarray. If you were king, what would you do? It's hardly a win-win scenario here, right? I'll tell you what. When once again faced with a difficult decision, David does nothing. Again, he sits on his hands. Absalom flees the city. He's gone for 3 years. David doesn't pursue him. David doesn't reach out to him. David does nothing. Absalom's free to go. He knows he's not welcome in Jerusalem, but he spends 3 years outside the city. I think David knew deep, deep down that he created this little mess. I think that he knew that because the choices he made earlier had consequences later, cause and effect. You know, if he had enough discipline to do the right thing the first time, he probably could have saved everyone a lot of heartache. And I want to talk about that word discipline for a moment because I think there's two ways that we can typically view that word. Discipline, right? If you go to the gym every single day, you have a lot of discipline. You're self-disciplined, right? It's good practice that you put in there. But there's another way to view that word discipline. We could see it as punitive. If you cut class, you get detention. That is a disciplinary action, right? So there's two words to view the word discipline. You know what looks a lot like the word discipline? This word. Disciple. And so you might be thinking, disciple, I've heard that word. Jesus had 12 of those guys. They followed him around. How does this make any sense? They share a Latin root word, okay? Disciple is another word for a follower or a student or a pupil or a trainee. How does any of this make sense? I'll tell you. Discipleship begins with discipline. Discipleship begins with discipline, literally and figuratively. Hear me out on this. If David had had enough discipline, he wouldn't have had that man killed so he could steal his wife. If Amnon had enough discipline, he wouldn't have raped his own sister. If Absalom had enough discipline, he wouldn't have murdered his brother. We don't exist in a bubble. The choices that we make affect others, cause and effect. So the question I want to ask to you is, who is watching your choices? Who's watching your choices? Could it be that you're discipling people and you don't even know it? David looked the other way after his daughter's rape. He didn't punish Amnon. He'd allowed Absalom to kill Amnon. David's sons were his disciples, and they were following his lead. Who are you discipling? Who's following your lead, and where are you taking them? Do you think that you can be cold and distant to your spouse and still have a good relationship? Do you think that you can unnecessarily yell at your children and crush their little souls or break your promises to them and still hope to have some semblance of a relationship with them? Do you think that you can sow seeds of discord or gossip or lie about other people and it won't come back to haunt you? Discipleship begins with discipline. Who are you leading and where are you taking them? Now, where is God in all of this? We're talking about this. We haven't brought up God yet. Where is he? Maybe it's easier to think that all the bad things that you do, God is far away, but he's watching and he's somehow punishing you. He's mitigating justice throughout the universe. In fact, it might be easier to think that there's some governing deity far away and that we're not to blame for our own choices. That's just God punishing us. But maybe, just maybe, the decisions I've made have put myself in this very position. God doesn't punish us for wrongs, But he does allow us to bear the weight of our own decisions, cause and effect. Now, David didn't rule his kingdom alone. No, when you're a king, every good king needs a delegate. Enter Joab. Joab is David's right-hand man. He's the chief of staff for David's kingdom. And he's been there since the very beginning, if you read the story of David. When David had his first battle, Joab ran into battle with him. When David was hiding in caves from King Saul, Joab was there. And when David wanted to have a man murdered so that he could take his wife, Joab pulled the trigger. Joab makes the tough decisions in the kingdom. He's the chief of staff. He's got his eyes out. And he sees that David is in deep distress about all this family stuff that's happening. And this makes Joab nervous. Because when your king stops making decisions and he becomes paralyzed, it's only a matter of time before your enemies notice. So Joab's a bit worried. So Joab hatches a plan for the good of the realm. He's going to reconcile Absalom and David. He's going to bring the two together, make peace between the two, so David can move on. So Joab goes to David. He says, hey, king, I want to make an appeal to you. Why don't you let Absalom return to the city? And David, still broken up about the whole thing, agrees to let Absalom come to the city, but he will not see him and he will not talk to him. 2 Samuel chapter 14. Absalom lived in Jerusalem for 2 years, but he never got to see the king. Then Absalom sent for Joab to ask him to intercede for him, but Joab refused to come. Absalom sent for him a second time, but again, Joab refused to come. So Absalom said to his servants, go and set Joab's barley field on fire, the field next to mine. So they set his field on fire as Absalom had commanded. Then Joab came to Absalom at his house and demanded, why did your servants set my field on fire? And Absalom replied, because I wanted you to ask the king why he brought me back from Geshur if he didn't intend to see me. I might as well have stayed there. Let me see the king. If he finds me guilty of anything, then let him kill me. So Joab told the king what Absalom had said. Then at last David summoned Absalom, who came and bowed low before the king. And the king kissed him. So Absalom, like a petulant child who's being ignored, acts out to get dad's attention, right? He lights Joab's field on fire. Joab goes to the king, and then they try to make peace. Now, here's the thing. What Absalom's really doing is challenging his dad's authority. Because when you're the king, you can do whatever you want. And King David very easily could have said, hey, you know what? You've caused a lot of trouble for me. I'm going to kill you right now. And that would have been fine. David could have very easily done that. Would have been well within his right as king. But Absalom is smart. And he's thinking, there was no punishment for Amnon. Dad didn't come to get me. Dad's weak. He's not in decision-making mode. He's going to kill me. I'm the heir. Forget it. I'm going to show up. I'm going to act like everything's cool. I'll bow low before him, and I'll humble myself. So it would appear that the two of them had reconciled, but not really. Absalom is young. He's good-looking. He's well-liked and obviously smart. And what does every good-looking, well-liked, passionate young person know the answer to? Everything. Am I right? Everything. Kids know everything. And so he's thinking, Dad's old. We're going to need a new leader soon. I'm next in line. Maybe it's time for me to step up that timeline again. But remember, Absalom is a slow player. He plays it cool. And so he puts into effect a plan that lasts 4 years. He does a routine for 4 years straight. And this is what he does. 2 Samuel chapter 15. Absalom bought a chariot and horses, and he hired 50 bodyguards to run ahead of him. He got up early every morning and went out to the gate of the city. When people brought a case to the king for judgment, Absalom would ask where in Israel they were from, and they would tell him their tribe. And Absalom would say, you've got a really strong case here. It's too bad the king doesn't have anyone to hear it. I wish I were the judge. Then everybody could bring their cases to me for judgment, and I would give them justice. When the people tried to bow before him, Absalom wouldn't let them. Instead, he took them by the hand and kissed them. Absalom did this with everyone who came to the king for judgment, and so he stole the hearts of all the people of Israel. So Absalom buys himself a chariot, he upgrades his ride, and then he gets 50 bodyguards. He's the heir to the king in a peaceful city. He doesn't need 50 bodyguards. He's paying for an entourage. That's what you do when you're deeply insecure and you need to prove that you have influence. You pay other people to follow you around, like you look like you have power and influence. So Absalom buys an entourage to look like he's got some power and some swag. And then every morning, he gets up early in the morning and he goes to the gate of the city. Remember, Jerusalem's the capital city, so people from all over Israel are coming there to see the king. When you're a king, you hold court. Surely you've seen this, right? A king sits in his throne, people come before the king, they speak their grievances, and the king will decide yes or no. Before they can even get into the court, Absalom stops him. He's like, hey, I'm the prince. I'm really good looking. Tell me your story. Let me hear your story. Tell me. Oh, wow, that's crazy, man. It's really bad. It's too bad the king can't see you. But you know what? One day I'm going to be king, and I'll take care of that for you. So he's sowing seeds of discord slowly. He does this for 4 years. He's giving everyone the impression that he's going to do a much better job than dear old dad. How did this happen? Let me ask you this. Do you think David giving Absalom the cold shoulder for 2 years was a good idea? Do you think that his choice to not act after all this terrible stuff happened could have maybe brought him to this point? Do you think Absalom would be acting the same way if David had taken some action? David looked the other way after his daughter's rape. He didn't punish Amnon. He allowed Absalom to kill Amnon without impunity, and then decides, I don't feel like talking about it for 2 years. Cause and effect. So, Absalom does this little charade, this little routine for 4 years. What do you think happens? One day he goes up to dad. He says, hey, dad, there's a city that's nearby, a nearby city. I'd like to go visit the city. I'll go give a sacrifice to God over there, just like our ancestors did. It'll be really great. And so David says, yeah, go on, boy. Go have a good time. I think David knew that something was up because he's not an idiot. We've seen this in Scripture. He's a smart guy. You know what I think? I think he had analysis paralysis. You've heard this term before, where you're overthinking something so much you don't know what the right decision is, so you just freeze. I think he allowed Absalom to go because he just didn't know what to do. And sure enough, Absalom goes. He takes a trip to this neighboring city, and while he's there, he rallies everyone. He puts on a crown and crowns himself king. A kingdom can't have two kings. 2 Samuel chapter 15. A messenger soon arrived in Jerusalem to tell David, all Israel has joined Absalom in a conspiracy against you. We must flee at once or it'll be too late, David urged his men. Hurry, if we get out of the city before Absalom arrives, both we and the city of Jerusalem will be spared from disaster. Absalom now has supporters, he has an army, and he moves to take the capital city, and David flees. He goes into hiding in the wilderness. I'm thinking now is probably the moment where David fully realizes what he set into motion. Absalom does take the city. He crowns himself king, and he immediately assembles an army to hunt down dear old dad. What's fascinating here is that David is old. He's in the last quarter of his life, but this isn't the first time he's had to run away from a mad king. He spent nearly 10 years in the wilderness while King Saul was chasing him. And you think that maybe that was enough of a struggle for him, but now his own son wants to murder him. And again, the story is lengthy. I'm condensing a bunch of chapters here, but I think that David knew that Absalom would come for him. I think he knew that this day was going to come, but he had a hard time making a decision there. So David knows a war is coming. David has some supporters, a small band of them. David, being the smart battle guy that he is, decides that there's going to be a war, but it's going to be on his terms. He selects this really thick, dense forest for the battlefield to occur, and he tells Joab and he tells all his soldiers, I'm too old to go into battle with you. Guy probably can't even swing a sword at this point, but he tells them, look, if you find Absalom, be gentle with him. Do not harm him. Do not kill him. He is my son. Be gentle. He tells this to Joab. He tells this to all the troops, every single one there. So a battle ensues in this dense forest. And the Bible actually describes it. This battlefield was so dangerous. I'm envisioning a lot of low-hanging branches. The forest is so thick and dense that more men died riding into the forest than were actually put to the swords. This is a terrible place to have a fight. So a battle ensues. People are dying everywhere. And Absalom, young, handsome Absalom, with his beautiful five-pound head of hair, rides into this forest, and his beautiful locks become entangled in a low-hanging branch, if you can believe this, right? He gets tangled up, and the animal he's riding keeps going. So he's hanging from a low branch, his hair completely knotted up inside of it. And who comes upon Absalom first? Our good buddy Joab. You remember Joab, right? Chief of staff, makes the hard decisions for the kingdom. Absalom set his field on fire. Joab knows what the king said. He was there. But Joab's got to make the tough decision, right? What do you think Joab's going to do? He could pretty much end it right there. And that's exactly what he does. He walks up to Absalom and he plunges a dagger directly into his heart, killing him and ending the war. Joab made the tough decision. What do you think David's going to do when he hears about this? Do you think he'll be relieved? Maybe this was something that had to happen. Maybe David couldn't do it on his own. Maybe he'll make peace with it. 2 Samuel chapter 18. The king was overcome with emotion. He went up to the room over the gateway and burst into tears. And as he went, he cried, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Sometimes tragedies teach us a story that heroes never could. I want you to imagine for a moment Absalom, not as a hate-filled, vengeful, murderous young man, but as a tiny baby that the king once proudly cradled in his arms. That must have been what David felt at this moment. He didn't see a usurper. He didn't see a murderer. He saw his baby boy. To understand the life of King David is to understand power and what we as humans will do with that power. David was privileged. God chose him and he was permitted power, but that power was given to him to point to a greater king. And this king, we've been living in his kingdom the entire time. We may not even know it. And sometimes we don't like this king's decisions. Sometimes we see him as distant or careless or aloof. Sometimes we deliberately break the laws of his kingdom. We know what the kingdom laws are, but we still break them anyway. And sometimes, even like Absalom, we go ahead and crown ourselves king of this kingdom. But when this king looks upon you, he doesn't see a subject or a slave or a usurper. Whether you are young or old, he sees you as his child, whom he cares for very, very deeply. And we're called to follow this king, not as slaves, not as subjects, but as disciples, to trust him, to follow him, and discipline ourselves under his rule, because discipleship begins with discipline. So, a word of caution to those of you who are in your youth, that fire and that passion that you possess, that righteousness that you may burn with. It's powerful. It's amazing stuff. Have enough discipline to balance it. I hope that the life of Absalom will serve as an example to you the next time you decide to take matters into your own hands. And for those of you who are maybe older, in the latter half or latter quarter of your life, what I want to say to you is don't coast on your legacy. Don't take your foot off the gas. Pay attention. Be present. Make the hard decisions. Your wisdom and your guidance is still needed. And I hope that the story in the life of King David will serve as a reminder to you that our choices have consequences, cause and effect. But if you practice discipline now, you won't have to deal with it later. Now, I want to add in closing that this story happens in the last quarter of David's life. And even though it is devastating and even though it is a tragedy, he manages to recover. He does put the kingdom back in order. He makes peace with all the terrible things that have happened and all the terrible things that he's done. And he is actually able to put a worthy successor on the throne, one who was just a tiny little baby when all this stuff happened. And on his deathbed, he gives Solomon one simple instruction. 1 Kings chapter 2. As the time of David's death approached, he gave this charge to his son Solomon. "I am going where everyone on earth must someday go. Take courage and be a man. Observe the requirements of the Lord your God and follow all his ways." Maybe so in my life, maybe so in yours. Let's pray. God, we thank you for these incredible, incredible stories and illustrations in your word. And I pray, God, that not only would we be inspired to study and understand them more, but I pray that the parallels in them, Father, would intersect with our own life. God, I pray that we would realize the weight of our decision making. I pray that you would give us pause the next time we decide to make a decision that will have effect somewhere else. I pray that you would give us the wisdom and the discipline to be cautious, and I pray that we would would always be mindful of who we might be leading and where we are taking them. Teach us that way, Father, and help us to know that we can trust you and follow you. In your name we pray. Amen.